From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The recent use by police of pepper spray at UC Davis has raised many questions, like what does the law say about the right to peaceable assembly? How are police usually trained in the use of pepper spray? And what is pepper spray and what does it do to you? Today we're going to get answers to all those questions, but we start with an update on what's happening at UC Davis. Joining us from our downtown Capital Bureau is Capital Public Radio State Government reporter Ben Adler, who was at the noon rally yesterday at UC Davis. Ben, welcome back to Inside.
Hey, good morning, Jeffrey.
Well, what happened yesterday?
Oh, what happened yesterday? Well, the big highlight of the day was a noon rally that stretched on for several hours. But for a good first hour or so, speaker after speaker took to the microphone, some of whom were pepper sprayed or arrested on Friday, some of whom were faculty or union leaders, some of the unions not affiliated with the university, others are affiliated with the university. And there were many, many calls, not just for the police, the campus to police, campus police to be basically no longer allowed on campus and you know, have the department dissolved, but also for Chancellor Linda Katehi to resign. And here's an example of one of the people who spoke. It's Nathan Brown, an assistant professor of English who's also on the Davis Faculty Association board. He started an online petition calling for the chancellor's resignation, and he pointed out to the crowd that Chancellor Katehi was directly left of the stage just as he was speaking, and so he directed his words at her, and he said that he saw in the chancellor's statement since Friday the same techniques of backpedaling and obfuscation that are used by the powers that be every time there is an act of police violence in the country. And he went on to say,
her efforts are transparent. They are efforts to defer and displace criticism. They are efforts to defer and displace calls for her resignation. Those calls now number in the tens of thousands.
That was a professor calling for Linda Katehi's resignation yesterday. As you said, she was in the crowd and she spoke, didn't she?
She did, but the other thing is she just had to wait her turn, basically. In fact, a couple of student organizers kind of gleefully pointed out when the crowd started chanting, let her speak, let her speak, they said she's in line and she'll wait her turn like everyone else. When she did finally get up there, she said, she told the students, and there were thousands of them there, I know you may not believe anything that I'm telling you today, and you don't have to. It is my responsibility to earn your trust. And then she went on to reference her own experience in Greece in the 1970s at another violent event involving students. Students in Athens went on strike. They barricaded themselves inside a university to protest the Greek military regime. And the government sent a tank crashing through the university gates. Hundreds injured, dozens died. And then Katehi pointed to one side of the UC Davis quad and said there's a plaque out there that speaks about November 17th, 1973, with her voice breaking, she said, I was there, and I don't want to forget that. Here's a little bit more of what she had to say.
I'm here to apologize. I really feel horrible for what happened on Friday. If you think you don't want to be students in a university like we had on Friday, I'm just telling you, I don't want to be the chancellor of the university we had on Friday.
Now, of course, there were lots of students there, too, and some of them spoke. What did they say?
Well, the students who spoke actually at the event itself on stage were highly critical of the administration and of the police. They talked about their experiences being pepper sprayed, arrested, and so on and so forth. And I did also talk to a student who was around there afterwards, but not one of the speakers, and it's Senior Ahmed Rahim. And he was kind of conflicted in terms of, you know, whether the chancellor should step down. He understood that it was the chancellor who called in the police in the first place to displace the campsite, but he pointed out that in his mind she can't be blamed for something she didn't do, which is actually harm the students. As for what the chancellor could have said that would have placated the crowd, Rahim said probably nothing.
I think the people were already, they made up their minds about what they wanted to hear from her, and Chancellor Kate didn't exactly get a chance to really say what she wanted. Even though she was up there for a couple of minutes, there's nothing she could have said that would have, improved the situation that the experience of the students faced.
Now, the Friday incidents were about moving students who were and their tents, but students actually spent the night again at UC Davis last night.
Yeah, about 60 tents were there this morning, according to a UC Davis spokeswoman. But she also said that things were pretty quiet on the quad this morning, even though there were the tents there. So the university not moving the tents out just yet. I would imagine that after Friday's incident, they're going to be a little bit more deliberate in terms of trying to figure out what to do or not to do about the campsite that is springing up again there. Meantime, Chancellor Katehi is going to attend a student forum tonight, 5 p.m. at Reborn Hall.
Ben Adler, Capital Public Radio state government reporter. He was at UC Davis yesterday. Ben, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Well, we also talked about the UC Davis pepper spray incident yesterday, and listener Wheeler Cowperthwaite wrote this in our Facebook page. Do the protesters not have a right to peaceable assembly? It seems the First Amendment is pretty explicit in that right. Does this kind of attack by police and students or citizens not constitute assault? If it doesn't, why doesn't it? Those are the words of Wheeler Cowperthwaite writing on our Facebook page. We thought those were fair questions, so we've invited to our studio an expert on constitutional law, specifically free speech and government speech. She's Leslie Gilo-Jacobs, Professor of Law and Director of the Capital Center for Public Law and Policy at University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. Leslie Gilo-Jacobs, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Well, the right to peaceable assembly, the Constitution says Congress may not restrict that. How does that fit in with people who are protesting overnight somewhere and the people who run that place say, no, you can't stay here?
Well, it's true. The Constitution does say Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or the right to peaceably assemble. But it can't possibly mean that Congress can make no law whatsoever. Imagine if the protesters wanted to camp out on Interstate 80. It seems like, of course, the police, we would think, would be able to move them. So what the Constitution means is that the government's reason for stopping the speech and the speaker's interest have to be balanced to determine exactly what the government can do.
In other words, I guess the government can't break up an assembly simply because of the expression of speech. It needs to be for some other purpose, like public safety or health or whatever.
Exactly right. If indeed police are aiming at the message of what the protesters are saying, that's probably unconstitutional. But if there's some law that's aiming at the conduct that the protesters are doing, then the question is, are they allowed to speak that way, or is it a law where the government can enforce it?
It seems, though, that there could easily be gray areas here. How do you know for sure what the intention of the government agency is that's moving people on?
Well, you'd be looking actually at the rule that they're trying to enforce. I mean, if it's a no camping regulation, then they're enforcing a no camping regulation. And so long as they enforce it against everybody, regardless of whether they're protesters or not, then probably they're going to be able to do it. Although sometimes it's possible that people would be speaking through their conduct and be able to do it, whereas other people wouldn't be able to do it.
I remember a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about the Occupy movement more generally, and a lawyer in Sacramento who was representing Occupy Sacramento people said that the occupation, quote unquote, is an inherent part of the protest of the Occupy movement. And so that his argument was that you can't remove the occupation from the Occupy movement. It's part of the protest. Does that add up in your mind?
Well, it's certainly true that they would think that and that they would want to speak that way. It's the hardest to be able to speak by means of conduct. That is, if they wanted to get out and hold up signs in a street or a sidewalk or a park, they'd almost certainly be able to do that. But when it gets into doing things like sleeping overnight in a park where there are rules that generally apply to people, regardless of whether they're speaking or not, well, then the government may well be able to enforce that.
My guest is Leslie Gilo-Jacobs. She's a professor of law at Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. She's an expert on constitutional law, including free speech. The Constitution refers to Congress not abridging the right of ... What does that mean? Does that mean it only applies to federal law? And if so, how does that apply to state agencies like the University of California, or for that matter, local agencies like the City of Sacramento?
Well, when it was initially put in the Constitution, it applied only to Congress. That is, the First Amendment did. But now the court has interpreted it to apply to any sort of government, state, local, federal. Any sort of government is bound by what the Free Speech Clause says.
Yes. Now, of course, we're talking generally here, and I'm sure you don't want to come up with a legal ruling on the specifics of what happened at UC Davis on Friday. But as we understand, the police were told to move people who were intending to camp there for the night. And as I understand, UC Davis rules do not allow that. If that were the case, would the police be entitled to move them along, setting aside the pepper spray?
Well, certainly, yes. I mean, if the rule says you can't camp and they're simply enforcing it, it seems like it would be. I mean, obviously, the pepper spray raises a whole separate issue, and it's an issue that's not a free speech clause issue. It's actually an issue under the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, talking about unreasonable searches and seizures. And a police officer could potentially commit a constitutional violation by using excessive force.
And so what does the Fourth Amendment say, then, a little more specifically about the use of pepper spray?
Well, it doesn't obviously talk about pepper spray, but it talks about unreasonable searches. And so when you use pepper spray, you're actually touching somebody's body with something. And so the question would be whether the threat was there, whether the government's interest in moving the people were strong enough, and whether it looked perhaps like they were resisting arrest. That's the test a court has developed.
I see. Is the constitutional right to peaceable assembly, is this something that's been litigated a lot and discussed a lot before the Supreme Court over the, well, I was going to say the years, but really the decades and centuries might even be more appropriate. It seems that that's a part of the First Amendment that gets less notice and publicity than, say, free speech.
Explicitly, it does get less publicity. I think it gets wrapped up in the free speech guarantee. That is, when you're petitioning, you're speaking, and lots of the free speech cases have to do with protests against government, war protest, all sorts of different types of protests. Yeah. One other thing I should note here, too, that is, although the Free Speech Clause may not directly protect what these protesters were doing because they were engaged in conduct, I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that we have a Free Speech Clause is the reason why this is getting so much publicity. And the reason it was able to go viral is because we don't have governments that think they're able to go around censoring the internet. And so the public reaction to this is certainly not a constitutional limit, but it's one that's going to constrain all sorts of police officers from now on.
And finally, Leslie Gillow-Jacobs, whenever anything like this crops up in the news, people talk, and not surprisingly, about free speech rights and so on, that these are constitutionally protected. And it does seem that there's a general sense among the public that these are absolute rights that can't be abridged. But you're saying that there are, in fact, many ways in which they can be abridged.
Well, certainly. And again, the Interstate 80 example, I mean, there are all sorts of ways that people's free speech rights are abridged. And the real question, as I said before, is whether the government is aiming at censoring somebody's message. Okay, governments really, really, really can't do that here in the United States. But if the government is enforcing a neutral rule that doesn't have to do what somebody's saying, is just saying, for example, you can't have massive posters up, you know, on a freeway bridge, well, that would be more like be okay.
And presumably that rule would have to be in place before the protest started, not implemented after the protest starts as an end run around the Constitution, I guess.
Well, not as an end run, but actually it does happen that these things do get implemented sometimes afterwards, and sometimes they're okay, sometimes they're not. You're exactly right. The question is, what's the purpose?
Leslie Gillow-Jacobs, professor of law and director of the Capital Center for Public Law and Policy at University of the Pacific McGeorge School of Law in Sacramento. Thanks so much.
I was happy to be here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, more on the UC Davis pepper spray incident. We'll hear more about pepper spray and its effects on people and how police are usually trained in its use. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Joining us today with Insight Online is senior producer Jen Picard. Hi, Jen.
Hi, good morning. Well, yesterday we asked for your thoughts about the use of pepper spray at that peaceful protest on the UC Davis campus last week. Jason Waters wrote that pepper spray should not be used by officers trying to disperse peaceful protests under any conditions. Out of all the coverage I have heard no evidence that the police were in any danger other than being outnumbered by the protesters, which is not a good enough reason to take out and use an equalizer. The police have been showing immense cowardice in protest situations for years. Listener Joe Dobbs had a different take, though. The UC Davis students were protesting. The police asked them to move. They ignored the requests. The police took the least egregious steps to remove them. There are consequences to actions. What should the police have done? Threaten them with calling their mommies?
As it turns out, a couple of yesterday's topics elicited reaction from listeners.
Yep, that's right. It was a very busy show. In response to our segment about four California trucking companies suing the Environmental Protection Agency over new emission standards, Rick Palkovic wrote, "Why not invite someone from the environmental community to participate in the Insight discussion instead of just asking the EPA? Someone needs to speak on behalf of the EPA regulations on diesel engines."
Well, it's a fair question, but we were focusing on the newsmakers, so hence our interest in speaking to the EPA. We did invite the EPA to participate in the discussion, but they declined. We also asked them to send us a statement, but they did not do that.
Yes, indeed. And we also heard from listener Pam Levy, who had a negative reaction to our segment with philosophy professor Joseph Lynch, who talked about whether animals suffer pain. I found this discussion extremely disturbing and quite upsetting. Try nursing a beloved cat through the last stages of liver failure and tell me she did not suffer. I realize some people might find this an interesting topic, but should have been reserved for another time. Like never. If you have any questions or comments on any of the topics you hear on Insight, let us know on our Facebook page, Insight at Capital Public Radio, or send an email to insight@capradio.org. And don't forget to check out our website, www.capradio.org/insight, where you can find out more information on all of our guests and topics and watch a video of UC Davis Chancellor Linda Katehi and others speaking at yesterday's rally on the UC Davis Quad.
Thank you, Jen.
You're welcome.
Now we're going to turn to pepper spray itself, this substance that we've heard so much about in the last few days. Specifically, we're going to talk about what it is and how it affects people. And we got the idea for this from Insight listener and journalist and pet expert Gina Spadafori, who posted on our Facebook page that pepper spray was of interest in itself and suggested science writer and blogger Deborah Blum, who is also author of The Poisoner's Handbook and professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She has blogged on the subject of pepper spray, and she joins us by phone. Deborah Blum, welcome to Insight.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, what is pepper spray? Is it literally spray made out of pepper?
It isn't, but it's a sort of synthetic chemical version of the compounds in peppers that make them so spicy. They're called capsaicins, and they directly affect your nervous system.
How does pepper spray, how does the experience of being pepper sprayed compare with getting some pepper, you know, granules of pepper in your face or in your eyes?
That's a great question. And one of the things I did when I wrote my blog about pepper spray was I looked at something called the Scoville scale, which is the big measurement for the burn intensity of peppers. And at the bottom of it, you find sweet bell peppers. And at the top of it, you find the pure capsaicin. So bell peppers are a zero. Habaneros, which are pretty darn spicy, are about 350,000. And police-grade pepper spray is 5.3 million on the Scoville scale. So it is off the charts. And to get that kind of intensity, you really have to mix it up into a laboratory. So this is nothing domestic. It is nothing like what you would happen if you even took something like a habanero and rubbed it in your eyes. It is a lot worse than that.
What exactly is it like? Do you know? Have you personally experienced it?
I haven't. And interestingly, I saw one journalist just asking if he should do this to show. But interestingly enough, back in the 1990s, a lot of police officers are required to get sprayed with pepper spray so they know what it's like as part of their training. But back in the 1990s in North Carolina, police officers actually challenged this. They said there were too many adverse effects, and it was invested by the health department in North Carolina, and they concluded that this was abuse of police officers. There were too many of them injured by pepper sprays, and some of them had headaches, eye damage, and asthma that lasted for more than a week afterwards. So in that case, they said, this is nothing we even want our officers exposed to.
My guest is Deborah Blum, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer and blogger, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, and she's a professor of science journalism at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're talking about pepper spray. Pepper spray has this general air of it, of being what police in Western countries use as a sort of kinder, gentler, toxic agent to disperse crowds. Is it fair to see it that way?
You know, it's not going to drop you dead in your tracks. And it's interesting because on my blogs, people came on and they said, well, you know, this is so much better than shooting the protesters. And I'm thinking, well, duh, sure. It's not an immediately lethal substance in the kind of dose that you get sprayed with. It can have some serious short-term and some long-term health effects. And if you have some underlying conditions like asthma, there have been deaths associated, you know, a very small number of deaths associated with that. It's far from benign. And in fact, one of the interesting things about pepper spray is that in some ways it's more hazardous than tear gas, because tear gas is just an irritant, whereas pepper spray, because it's based on capsaicins, the primary compound in peppers, actually directly affects your nervous system. So you get both the kind of caustic burn effect and an effect on your nervous system at the same time. So my point in writing about it was to say, couldn't we be a little bit better informed? And if we're better informed, aren't we going to try to be a little more cautious in our use of this?
So you are not arguing that pepper spray should not be used by police in the United States or elsewhere. You were saying that that we need to know more about it. The general public, at any rate, needs to know more about it so that it is used perhaps less often.
I'm saying, yes, it should be used. That it's not a nice, benign way of controlling your crowd chemically, which is the way it tends to be sold, right? This keeps all of us safe and hardly harms anyone. I'm saying that it's a chemical agent that's strong enough that, in fact, the U.S. Army, U.S. military, under international treaty, is not allowed to use it in warfare. Right? But we'll use it. We accept that our police officers in this country can use it to control American citizens. And so what I'm really arguing is that we should take another look at that, and we should take another look at the frequency of its use, and we should be very honest, both on the law enforcement side and on the citizen side, about how hazardous this can be.
Deborah Blum, Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer, author of The Poisoner's Handbook, professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, now let's get a law enforcement perspective on this. How are police trained when and how to use pepper spray? Joining us on the phone is David Rose. He's a retired sheriff's lieutenant, and he's an expert in police practices. He teaches police practices. David Rose, welcome to Insight.
Well, thank you.
Generally speaking, how are police officers and their colleagues elsewhere in law enforcement trained in the use of pepper spray? When is it to be used and how should it be used?
Well, basically, each agency will have their own policy or procedure as to what circumstances or types of resistance that they face that would be appropriate for using OC spray. And I have to take disagreement with the prior person that you were interviewing, the professor, with I have personally been sprayed multiple times with various types of OC spray. The University of California San Diego School of Medicine has done many studies, and the National Institute of Justice has done many studies. The nation of Canada has done many studies on the actual use of OC spray in street situations, as well as scientifically valid studies, and they have found no deaths. In fact, the studies at UC San Diego Medical have shown that even people with asthma, it tends to increase their ability to exchange oxygen and oxygen gases. A lot of peace officers who have been sprayed, including myself, if it was true that it directly related to death, or cause deaths. There'd be literally tens of thousands of dead peace officers, as well as citizens throughout the United States, Canada, and the world.
But I don't think
what
critics
officers are trained to do are basically, if you meet a level of resistance that warrants the use of force, okay, and you have various force options available to you. If you look at, imagine a wheel, and on the outside of the wheel are all the force options that an agency allows or authorizes for a particular peace officer to use. The officer is trained to reach out and grab whatever the reasonable force option is for that circumstance. So if it's verbal commands, then he just reaches out and gives verbal commands. But if it's a situation where it warrants possibly the use of deadly force, he might give verbal commands and his firearm. He might just give verbal commands and go hands-on. The Ninth Circuit of the United States, which the West Coast has to follow their constitutional law, and keeping in mind that the definition of use of what's proper use of force is that which is reasonable for the circumstances the officer is facing. And the Ninth Circuit has determined that if you have, based on the Headwaters Forest case and the Forrester v. San Diego case and subsequent cases to that, including the latest Taser cases, the Ninth Circuit has a definition that they use of what they call a passive resistor. It's a little bit different than what officers have been taught over the years in the state of California is what a passive resistor is. But the Ninth Circuit has determined that if you have only a passive, nonviolent resistor, that they want you to use pain compliance techniques first, and then if those are ineffective, then you graduate up to other levels of force. The way the Ninth Circuit has determined OC spray, or where they've placed OC spray, is that they want you to use a use of force against a passive nonviolent resistor that once you have compliance, the pain immediately goes away. Now, the issue with OC spray, obviously, is depending upon your sensitivity to it, that ill effects or the painful effects of it can last anywhere from, maybe 15 minutes to as much as an hour, 2 hours, before you really, don't have any really major effects.
David, I just need to step in here just quickly, just so people know who you are. You're David Rose. You're a retired sheriff's lieutenant and an expert in police practices. And we're talking about pepper spray. You use the phrase OC spray, which I assume is the preferred term in law enforcement circles. Are you saying then that the police can legally use OC spray or pepper spray in certain situations, even with passive nonviolent resistors?
Well, let's put it to you this way. Up until the latest Ninth Circuit decisions, that was true. But they have now, in the Ninth Circuit, determined that if they look at a situation and they determine they're passive resistors, nonviolent passive resistors, they want you to try some other hands-on force first. The problem that we're facing in law enforcement is because of the advent of these non-hands-on less lethal techniques such as oleoresin capsicum spray, such as tasers, is that some agencies have decided that rather than run the risk of having officers physically engage with suspects and having one or both of those parties get injured, because whenever gravity is at play with the human body, the risk of injury is inherent, that they would rather have them go hands-off and resort to OC spray or tasers. And so now the Ninth Circuit is getting a lot of cases, as well as the state level, are getting a lot of cases where agencies have chosen to back off on their hands-on training and emphasize, whether intentionally in their policy or procedure or just through the way they discipline officers who have gone hands-on, and a lot of officers now have become dependent on not going hands-on, either because they're not getting the training they need to feel confident in their hands-on skills, or their agency hasn't kept updated on the latest case law as it relates to using the non-hands-on less lethal, such as OC spray or taser.
David Rose, retired sheriff's lieutenant, an expert in police practices. He is in the Auburn area. David Rose, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, our news network turns to Grass Valley. You'll hear what's making headlines there, including the renaming of a homeless shelter in honor of one of Nevada County's most beloved residents. It's Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison. What's in the news today? Alan Ray, Capital Public Radio Senior News Editor, is in our newsroom. Alan, what's in the news?
Well, Jeffrey, as you well know, UC Davis continues to be the latest developments there. There is a rally by students at noon today, and Capital Public Radio's Bob Moffitt will be at that. And then this evening, between 5 o'clock and maybe 7, the Chancellor, Linda Katehi, will be meeting with students and answering their questions. That'll be interesting. Now, you're going to need to diagram this one. Democrats and the Obama campaign are displeased with Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney, in an ad running for his presidential hopefulness, says he quotes President Obama as saying, if we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose. Well, yes, President Obama did say that. But back in 2008, when he was running against John McCain, President Obama used that quote from John McCain. So John McCain actually said, if we keep talking about the economy, we're going to lose, which indeed McCain did. Now the Democratic National Committee is calling Mitt Romney a serial deceiver. Did you get at that all down? You got
I think
written?
I did.
Okay, yeah. Okay, well, you'll be tested on this one later.
I liked presidential hopefulness.
That would be presidential hopefulness, Mitt Romney. Well, he's not actually I guess he's a candidate, but, you know, it gets a little dicey sometimes. Yeah. Anyway, all that and much more coming up beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Alan Ray, thank you.
My pleasure.
Each Tuesday, we tap into the Insight News Network to find out what's happening in one of our communities. Today, we turn to Grass Valley and Nevada City. Joining us is Brian Hamilton, city editor, former sports editor at The Union, the newspaper for Grass Valley and Nevada City. Brian, welcome to Insight.
Good morning, Jeffrey. Thanks for having me.
Well, what's in the news today in Grass Valley?
Well, the news today, we've actually got a nice feature story on a veteran who was interred in a Japanese internment camp in World War II, who's recently received a Congressional Medal of Honor. A really nice story today on that, him sharing his perspective with, you know, after being interred, still wanting to fight for his country. It was a really touching story that Matthew Renda, our reporter, captured this morning.
Great. And other issues?
Well, one of the recent ones that you mentioned earlier as you went to break was the opening of Hospitality House, their new facility that's actually they just celebrated the open house on Saturday. This is an organization that's really taken care of our homeless in the community for the past 6 to 7 years. And it had been done by rotation of churches stepping up each weekend on a weekly basis to take care of the homeless folks, make sure they have a place to stay. And now they have a permanent facility, and it's opened up right down the street here from the newspaper.
And it's called Utah's Place.
That's right, after Utah Phillips, our famed folk singer and poet who passed away in 2008, and his wife, Joanna Robinson, has been instrumental in the organization, and she's actually a member of the board.
And Utah Phillips was not from Nevada County, but he spent much of his life there, and he was very much interested in social justice issues. So I would, having met Utah Phillips a couple of times, I'd guess he'd be quite honored by this.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Cindy Maple, who's the executive director of that organization, she told us that he actually made the first donation to Hospitality House back in 2004 to get this thing rolling. And Utah was very much well loved around here and well known. He was very visible. We saw him out at the Little League games and that sort of thing. So was very much an important part of our community.
My guest is Brian Hamilton, city editor at the Union newspaper. Now, as is the case in many communities, Nevada County is dealing with medical cannabis, and there's a proposed ordinance that's attracting a lot of attention.
Yeah, this is it's an interesting debate going on right now. You know, Nevada County, a large portion of our economy is actually on marijuana cultivation, and you know, it's hard to know exactly how much because the Economic Resource Council doesn't keep those kind of numbers, with it being more of an underground economy. But we recently did a series of stories on marijuana in Nevada County, and one thing we found was folks in some of the smaller neighborhoods raising issue with people actually cultivating right next door, as opposed to having a plot up in the Tahoe National Forest somewhere. They're actually, you know, down the street from a school. And there's been a lot of issues raised about that. There's a group that's been formed, Nevada County Against Residential Cannabis Cultivation. And a good example of this is just last Friday, the county sheriff's department made an arrest of a couple that owned three properties within Lake of the Pines, a gated community where 135 pounds of marijuana was seized.
I was thinking more of the San Juan Ridge, not Lake of the Pines.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, a lot of people associate that up there, but the reality is it becomes probably more mainstream and more acceptable in terms of medicinal value. Folks are growing it right in the backyard.
Now, another issue that's been quite controversial in Nevada County is the issue of the name of a creek. And the name of the creek has been considered to be offensive, but there's some discussion about how or whether to change it.
Yeah, that's right. The apparently a resident, Rough and Ready area, raised an issue with a creek named Negro Creek, that it was offensive, and the U.S. Board of Geographic Names have asked the County Board of Supervisors to change it from Negro Creek to Butterfly Creek. And initially, the Board of Supervisors were opposed to that, with saying that they thought the historical value was too important to make that change. But now they've decided at the most recent meeting to consult with the NAACP to get their perspective on it, as they didn't feel that they were the best jury of what is pejorative in this case.
Mm. My guest is Brian Hamilton, city editor at the Union newspaper in Grass Valley. The people in Nevada County are going to be asked soon, I think, whether they want to pay more for fire protection.
That's true. That's definitely a hot-button issue right now. And we have a Nevada County Consolidated Fire District, and they're looking to put on the ballot an increase in fees that would essentially come to about $52 more per single-family dwelling. And right now they're paying about $100, so it would be a good jump.
Yes. Now, tourism is a big deal in Nevada County, and for good reason. Lots of nice places to go there. But there's some controversy over an attempt, a campaign to promote tourism. What's going on there?
Well, there's been quite a bit of effort to promote tourism in the area. I mean, that's really our main industry right now. The lack of construction and real estate jobs that have been kind of powering our economic community in the boom has now subsided, and really tourism is where it's at. So they've been trying to make efforts to bring more people here to see and showcase Nevada County. And some of the things that we've heard is that there's not a real concerted effort. Everyone's not joined together on this. The county's doing one thing. The cities are doing another. The recent FLAP came up with the county approving $50,000 to the regional chambers without actually going through a bid process. There was a similar situation with Grass Valley not putting its contract out to bid, and people just think they're seeking more of a cohesive effort on that front.
I see. And speaking of tourism, although this is something that appeals to locals as well as people visiting Grass Valley, there are various holiday activities, annual ones, coming up in Grass Valley, but also Nevada City.
That's right. You know, it's really a great time. If people haven't been up this way, certainly the fall colors right now are a good reason to come up. But with the holidays, Cornish Christmas, which is a celebration each Friday leading up to Christmas, is in Grass Valley, beginning this Friday. And it's really a step back in time. You can, in both cities, also Victorian Christmas is in Nevada City. That starts December 7th on Wednesdays and Sundays. And it's really a chance for folks to kind of take a trip back in time and visit the Gold Rush era architecture with a real traditional type of Christmas setting with chestnuts roasting on an open fire in both cities. Cecil Snow, aptly named, handles that each year.
Yes. And for people who are not familiar, Cornish in the context of Grass Valley refers to the origin of some of the original miners in Grass Valley from Cornwall in southwest England. And so this is a celebration of that culture and food that those people brought over.
That's right. You know, they were brought over because they had the skill in extracting that the gold from the quartz once it switched from more of the hydraulic and that sort of thing. So they're very much a very big part of our culture here. And you can stop and get a pasty anytime you want.
Yes, those are very fine. They can be quite tasty. Well, Brian Hamilton, city editor at the Union newspaper for Grass Valley and Nevada City, thanks so much for joining us today.
Not a problem, Jeffrey. Glad to be here.
You're listening to Insight. When we come back, a one-man musical show about Charlie Chaplin comes to Sacramento. You'll meet the singer and creator of the show, multi-platinum recording artist and songwriter David Pomeranz. You're listening to Inside from Capital Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Callison, and here's your weather. In the Sierra foothills today, it'll be sunny with a high in Sonora of 57, and in nearby Long Barn, just a few miles further up Highway 108, it's a nice day to enjoy some ice skating. A winter rink is open at the Long Barn Lodge on Long Barn Road, and today it's open through 5 p.m. Otherwise, in weather, 61 today in Sacramento, 60 in Marysville, 61 in Stockton. In the mountains, Tahoe City is expecting a high today of 44 and 53 in Carson City. Snow is likely around Tahoe on Thanksgiving Day. Rain likely in Thanksgiving Day in the valley and foothills. Musician David Pomeranz has sold tens of millions of records as either a singer or songwriter or both. His songs have been performed by artists like Barry Manilow, Bette Midler, Freddie Mercury, Cliff Richard and Clay Aiken, and have been used in Hollywood films. David Pomeranz's latest project is a one-man show, a theatrical concert about the life of film legend Charlie Chaplin. It plays in Sacramento this weekend. Right now he's on the phone with us. David Pomeranz, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Jeffrey. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. What gave you the idea to do your own one-man show about Charlie Chaplin?
Well, you know, I wrote the music and lyrics and co-book on a musical about Chaplin years ago that we had produced in England called Little Tramp. And it was a full cast version. You know, it had, I don't know, how many people in it, 30 or more people. And it did very well. We made an album of it on Warner Brothers and blah, blah, blah. And we did some smaller productions of it in the U.S. And then I got the idea that I would try to do this as a one-man show. First of all, we tried it as a three-man show, and then we kind of scaled it down little by little so that now it's basically me at and away from the piano doing 40 characters and performing the entire musical. So it's like a full-fledged cast musical with one guy.
Wow, that sounds like quite an undertaking.
That's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
And who are all these characters? Obviously, Charlie Chaplin's one of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, goodness, if you know anything about his life, first of all, it's a very interesting life. And it's filled with, you know, romance and betrayal and political intrigue and all the rest. And, of course, a great deal of heart and soul, very much like a Chaplin movie. But the characters are Max Sennett, the filmmaker, his various wives, the love of his life, Una, his mother, his brother, Sidney, and it goes on and on. It's the entire story of his life.
And the Chaplin estate, grandchildren, if they're still around or if it's generations below that, what do they make of the show? Have they seen it? Have they talked with you?
Oh, they love the show. In fact, it was told when I first began to write it, when it was in the days of cassette recorders, way back then, that Una Chaplin, Charlie's wife, who was then older, would walk around the house playing the music on her then Sony Walkman. So, you know, that was like the ultimate acknowledgement for me. And yes, they Una's no longer with us, but the children... we're very happy with what we've done.
My guest is a musician and songwriter, David Pomeranz. He's performing Chaplin, A Life in Concert, this Sunday afternoon at 3 at Sacramento's Crest Theater. You have had a very busy and successful career as both a musician in your own right, but as a songwriter. When you started out in the business, did you see yourself as a professional songwriter, or did that sort of come about as a natural extension of being a musician?
That's a good question. I thought of myself as both. I mean, I came up in that era, you know, where Paul McCartney and Elton John and those guys, you know, were writers, and James Taylor, they were my heroes, and they did both. So, however, there was one angle on this. When I was a little boy growing up in New York, I was particularly moved, I mean deeply moved, by musical theater. And I'd play West Side Story, or I'd play some of the Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals like Carousel and those kinds of things. And I was moved in a way that a pop or rock music didn't touch. You know, it was something different, which I also loved. So I guess you could say, you know, as a young guy growing up and getting record deals, it was pop music that the singer-songwriter thing was the thing that interested me. But there was always that burning interest to be a composer for the musical theater. And so with this project, I put them together.
Now, a lot of your songs have been recorded by other artists, some of them very famous artists, and I mentioned some of them when I was introducing you. What's it like hearing one of your songs performed and made a success by someone else? And I ask that in part because people often think that the singer of a song was the writer of a song.
Yeah, sure. Sure, they often do. Well, you know, it's a mixed thing. I mean, some artists, to be honest, you know, I'll kind of go, I think he missed the point there, or, you know, that has happened. And on the other hand, there have been renditions of my songs where I'd cry. I'd start blubbering like a baby. So it really depends on, you know, their take on it. It doesn't necessarily have to do with the quality of the artist either. Some of the greatest singers, I thought, missed the boat, and some of the others that nailed it and even took it far beyond my expectations. Mm. Sometimes took me by surprise. So it's an interesting question, and if we have more time, I could say in more detail. But basically, that's, you know, it can be a great joy or a little bit of an eyebrow raiser.
Yeah,
if you know what I mean.
Yes, I think I do. And it's impossible to encapsulate your career because you've worked all over the world. You've worked with many, many famous people in a wide variety of projects. So it's maybe not even a fair question, but I'll ask it anyway. If you think about all the people you've worked with and the things you've done, which is the fondest memory for you?
Wow. The fondest memory. Let me say a couple of things, and not to avoid the question, but just recently, I wrote a musical with Kathy Lee Gifford and David Friedman, and it was called Saving Amy, and we premiered in Seattle at the Fifth Avenue Theater just a few weeks ago.
Oh.
And there's that moment where, as a composer, you sit there and you get an actress like Carolee Carmello, who's a big Broadway star, who's our lead in our show, and so she's on, you know, 10 cylinders as a performer, and she's just a knockout. And then a gorgeous arrangement and a gorgeous setting, and then I sit there and I go, this is heaven. You know, this is all I ever want. You know, this moment, I am completely satisfied. I'm so happy. Mm. And there have been moments like that. So, to answer your question, so one was recent. And I have these moments throughout my life. I'm sure you do too. Everyone does, where there's a particularly, where you're home. You know, you're home, and all is right with the world. And I've had that experience several times musically. I guess one time, let's see, in performing the Charlie Chaplin show, there are nights, I'm sure you know what I mean, you know, when you're a performer, nights when you're in the zone.
Mm-hmm.
You're just in the zone, and it's working, and you're having fun, and you're emoting, and you're it's funny, and it's all the things, and the audience is with you. And you come off stage, and, you know, there's that moment where I'm by myself in the wings, and I give myself the thumbs up. I go, good man, you know, well done. And, you just know it, you know.
Yeah.
And it's those moments that make this such a joy, doing what I'm doing.
Is there any way to control being in the zone?
Oh, look, the zone is present time, isn't it?
Yeah, yes.
I mean, the zone is here, you know, and the guy's here. I've had the good fortune to study Scientology over the years. A guy called L. Ron Hubbard developed that. And there are certain techniques that I personally use to help me, before I go on stage, to help me sort of get out of my head and whatever chitter-chatter is going on there. Oh, my God, I'm afraid. Oh, what if they don't like me? Oh, all that. And there are certain techniques I use to sort of bring me right to present time. Mm-hmm. And if I go on the stage in that space, then chances are whatever happens out there, I'm there with it. Now, it's funny, but I think what the only thing that makes an audience ever uncomfortable is when the artist is uncomfortable. When something happens, the microphone falls on the stage. Yeah. Something happens, and it throws him. Well, if you're really there, and you go, oh, a microphone fell, and you pick it up and you make a joke.
Yeah.
Or you know what I mean? You handle it.
And yes.
So I think being in the present is the key.
Yeah. David Pomeranz, musician, songwriter, his one-man show, Chaplin, a one-man theatrical musical tribute to Charlie Chaplin, is in Sacramento this Sunday afternoon at 3 at the Crest Theater. David Pomeranz, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeffrey. It's a great pleasure to talk with you.
And that's Insight for this week. Insight returns on Monday. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Today's associate producer, Lynn Weaver. She's also engineer of today's program. The assistant producer, James Morrison. The technical director, Mark Jones. And the senior producer of Insight is Jen Picard. We're taking a Thanksgiving break, wishing you and yours a wonderful Thanksgiving. And as I said, we'll be back on Monday.